content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll begin today's program with a continuation of an article we began last week, titled An Artist for the Here and Now by Jay Cheshis. Long overlooked, Swedish painter Hilma af Klint made pioneering abstract art. Today she's a global star, but some scholars insist she should be sharing the spotlight. In the previous part of this article, we learned about Anna Cassell, who was part of af Klint's inner circle, and some historians believe that they were working together and that af Klint did not create her works by herself, but with the assistance of Anna Cassell. Af Klint and Cassell seem to have had a complicated relationship. The best friends in their 20s, perhaps more than that, they remained close throughout their lifetimes, even after tensions and disappointments, including a dispute about financing of af Klint's studio. In her notebooks, af Klint recorded conversations with Cassell and other women in her spiritual orbit that she said took place after their deaths. She refused to let them go because they are karmically tied to one another, Almquist said. One frosty fall afternoon, I visited Marie Cassell, Anna's 72-year-old great-niece, a retired teacher and social worker who is now working with two friends on researching a book about her great-aunt. Marie laid out a generous spread of pork sausages and warm potato salad in her apartment in a Stockholm suburb. Anna Cassell was my grandfather's sister, she said. She died in 1937. I was born in 1952. Marie grew up hearing little about her great aunt, picking up only a few fragments over the years. We knew she went to a Royal Academy, she said over lunch, and my aunts told me she had financed Hilma's work, and maybe they were lovers. She long wondered about Cassell's life as an artist, and after seeing af Klint's breakout show at the Moderna Museet, Marie said she became convinced Cassell had played a role in that work. How likely was it that Hilma painted 1,000-something paintings and Anna stood and stared, she said. As af Klint's fame grew, uncovering Cassell's story became an obsession. And the more Marie learned, the more she wondered about other members of their spiritual group. Their stories had vanished too. I'm not angry with Hilma af Klint, she told me. I want the truth. And isn't it more interesting if we say the work was a group work? Marie enlisted her ex-husband, an especially resourceful librarian, to help track down living relations of the other women in the five. They reached a descendant of Hedman, the medium. She inherited a stash of journals, she said, but is too spooked to share them. We understand she was afraid of the spirits, Marie said. They also found great nieces of the sisters Mathilde Nielsen and Cornelia Cederberg, Kirsten Freiberger, 91, and Birgit Lamke, 82, were also sisters. After lunch at Marie's place, we drove a short distance to meet the sisters at Freiberger's home. When Marie first reached out to them, she hoped they have more details, maybe even letters or journals to share, but Freiberger and Lamke had nothing. They hadn't even known of their relatives' connection to af Klint. It was you who made us aware, Freiberger said, a glass of white wine in her hand, looking over at her sister. Now in old age, they've started reading up on their ancestors. In the Central Library in Stockholm, they found copies of an esoteric magazine, afterwards Journal of Spiritism and Related Topics, which Nielsen had run as editor and contributor more than 100 years ago. By 1909, the five had dissolved. The first 111 paintings for the temple, including the 10 largest, were finished by then. Of the original group, only Cassell remained. Af Klint was collecting new disciples as she drove into Steiner's writing and lectures. She took a 4-year break from the paintings for the temple before completing the cycle in 1915. A few years later, she left Stockholm for Munso. I drove west to Munso on a rain-soaked Sunday morning with Johan af Klint and his niece Hedvig Ersman. To reach the island, a sprawling expanse of horse and cattle farms, we passed the Swedish royal resident at Drottningholm Palace. But I was most interested in the lonely spot on the waterfront where Off Klint built a studio in 1917, on a patch of wooded land owned by a family of a wealthy friend named Amelia Gierta, another member of her circle. Off Klint envisioned a residential community there, a sort of commune where she and her friends might live and work. On Munso, Off Klint began a new project, a close study of the natural world. "First, I will attempt to understand the flowers of the earth," she wrote in her notebooks. "Finally, I will penetrate the forest, exploring the silent mosses, the trees, and the many animals that inhabit the cool, dark undergrowth." The botanical drawings purchased by MoMA in 2022 appear to be part of that project, a botanical atlas, as Hauptmann, the MoMA curator, describes it, that Off Klint never completed. She had planned to build on ideas from Steiner, who devised the principles of biodynamic farming, a holistic system of crop production tied to the phases of the moon. In New York, Hauptmann told me that for Off Klint, this study was tied to her larger spiritual project. "This idea that close observation of the natural world will yield information on the human condition, that you can look at that birch tree, and if you really observe it, you can learn something about it, your own self. Steiner talks about some of that." Beginning in 1919, drawing in the blooming months, Off Klint completed a cycle of work focused on the plant life around her, but the project never went beyond that, and in 1922, when Off Klint turned 60, she moved in a new artistic direction, embracing a wet-on-wet style of watercolor painting she would continue to practice through the end of her life. She also devoted considerable time and energy to finding a home for her 193 paintings for the temple. She began spending extended periods of time in Switzerland, visiting the Anthroposophical Society headquarters in Dornach, hoping to convince Steiner to take them. In 1924, she wrote him a curt letter. "Should the paintings executed by me between 1906 and 1920, of which you, doctor, once saw several, be destroyed, or can they be used somewhere?" Steiner advised her to hold on to the works. She spent the next 20 years working, in vain, to find a permanent home for them, and eventually came to believe the world was not quite ready for them. In her notebook, she called them paintings for the future. Finally, in 1943, she received an offer from the Sigtuna Foundation, a Protestant organization, to build her a museum. She declined, putting the work one day in the hands of people who do not have an anthroposophical outlook might be problematic, she wrote. The following year, in October 1944, Off Klint stepped off a streetcar in Stockholm. She tried to steady herself but faltered and fell, banging her head and bruising her arm. Weeks later, just shy of her 82nd birthday, she succumbed to her injuries. Much of her art was stashed in the studio on Munso, on property now owned by Gierta's son. He gave the elder Erik Off Klint 3 months to clear out everything before he leveled the building. "This was a new generation with new ideas," Johan said, as we drove out toward the forest clearing where Off Klint's wood frame studio had stood. The building was gone, but the stone villa where Off Klint slept remained. Ehrsman, an architect, dreams of rebuilding the studio. "It looked like an American barn," she said. The site is already a stop on Off Klint's themed tour she's led through the region. "Below us, the road dead-ended at the water's edge, and we joined a line of cars awaiting the ferry across the strait to neighboring Adelso, where the Off Klint family once owned vast stretches of pastoral farmland. After spending childhood summers there, Off Klint returned later in life with her pencils and brushes. In her naturalistic paintings, you can see where she was," Johan said as we drove off the ferry and passed under a tunnel of pine trees. "You recognize the views," Ehrsman said. "Hilma was living in a city always, but she was, all her life from childhood, until the last year of her life, coming out here. On these lands, she developed her sensibility to life, to botany, to birds. In her art, she was carrying these places with her always and coming back to them." 4 years ago, Ehrsman helped a friend, Anna Maria Bernitz, an art historian, organize the first Off Klint tour here, a Hilma Off Klint safari, they called it. They led a caravan of cars filled with Off Klint groupies From the studio site on Munso onto the ring road around Adelso, past the former Off-Clint family estates and Hanmora and Tofta, sold off long ago, the Viking burial mounds, and the 12th century church with the Off-Clint family plot. Helma Off-Clint herself is buried there, interred with her parents in a small naval graveyard behind the maritime-themed Vasa Museum in Stockholm. The modest gravestone bears not Helma's name, but her father's. Commander Victor Off-Clint family grave, it reads. There are no markings at all to indicate that Helma Off-Clint lives there. In fact, you'll find no public memorials anywhere in Sweden to her life and work. No commemorative statue or plaque, neither in Stockholm nor on the islands where she found inspiration. Last spring, Ersman Tours got a permanent home, taking over a historic rectory. She plans to open the building this summer as the Helma Off-Clint Center Adelso, part cultural center, part artist residency. It won't be the temple of Off-Clint dreamed of for her art, but it will be something. A lot of people come to Stockholm and wonder, where do I go to see Helma Off-Clint, Ersman said. At the moment, there is no place. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Strange, Sudden, and Unexpected by Ben Nadoff Haffrey. A peculiar, short-lived office at the Smithsonian was dedicated to collecting reports of the most bizarre natural phenomena. Something was wrong with the squirrels of Appalachia. It was the fall of 1968, and they appeared to be making a sudden pilgrimage, attempting improbable swims across lakes, sprinting over highways, and bursting into buildings. One squirrel, while fleeing, climbed into a critical piece of infrastructure and reportedly short-circuited power to much of Clarksville, Georgia. The squirrel, the wire services reported, was also extinguished. The highway was lined with hundreds of dead squirrels. One scientist spotted 13 squirrels swimming due north across the reservoirs of North Carolina. Nothing could make them turn around. Assuming that squirrels must be starving, concerned citizens began sending boxes of acorns and hickory nuts to the afflicted areas, and grocery stores put up signs encouraging shoppers to feed the squirrels. The problem was that the squirrels were, by and large, well-fed. There was no shortage of food, yet by some estimates, 20 million squirrels were on the move. Wildlife officials were flummoxed, so they notified the Smithsonian Center for Short-Lived Phenomena. The CSLP was kind of a clearinghouse for news of intriguing phenomena that scientists might want to study as they occurred, from volcanic eruptions to oil spills, meteorite strikes, sudden islands, unusual migrations, and explosions in the populations of non-native species. Every day, an odd phenomenon occurred somewhere, offering a priceless natural experiment. But researchers worried they were missing most of them. For years, scientists have been aware of the almost total lack of essential research information on the very earliest beginnings of natural events. Sidney Galler, the Assistant Secretary for Science at the Smithsonian Institution, told Newsweek about how the idea for the CSLP had come about. We come in the middle and have to go back and attempt to reconstruct what actually happened. But now the Smithsonian had built an unprecedented network to help scientists get fast, accurate information about developing situations. We have our finger, said Robert Citron, the director of the center, on the pulse of planet Earth. In its 7 years of existence, the CSLP logged oil spills and ashen snowfalls, chased still warm meteorites, laid the foundation of a central global database of volcanic activity, and heralded the erroneous discovery of at least one prehistoric sea monster. And it left, in the archives of the Smithsonian, a rather large paper trail. Decades later, these archives are a window into a moment of epistemological uncertainty at the dawn of the environmental age, when nothing quite seemed to make any sense anymore, and concerned researchers were starting to piece it all together, one strange event at a time. Word of freak events like a mass squirrel migration arrived at the well-appointed CSLP offices in what was then the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The observatory had the kind of communications infrastructure that this new global scientific hotline required. At the center, at various points in its existence, a staff of nine hovered across four phone lines, teletypes, cable machines, and a shortwave radio set, fielding as many as 30,000 letters and cables per month, reporting short-lived phenomena. On the wall, it had a gigantic map of the world and a clock keeping military time. If the staff's minds, they kept working, if broad definition of short-lived phenomena, rare natural events that might otherwise go unobserved or uninvestigated. The CSLP relied on a network of scientists who sent in news of odd happenings. If something strange, sudden, and unexpected occurred anywhere on the planet, word would spread until a correspondent caught wind and sent the news to the center. There, the staff would generate a list of other correspondents who studied the relevant field. Volcanologists, presumably, for the Sudden Islands. Geologists for the diamond-encrusted meteorite that ripped through a Finnish farm's roof. Ornithologists for the 4 million blackbirds suddenly roosting in Scotland Neck, North Carolina. Entomologists for the ballooning spiders in St. Louis. Depending upon the urgency of the situation, Britain's Daily Telegraph explained, correspondents are informed by telephone, shortwave radio, cable, telegram, or postcard, which is airmailed if they live outside the New England area. Short-lived phenomena, it turned out, were often urgent. One center employee described the workplace atmosphere as something amounting to almost a panic situation. In its first 9 months, CSLP expanded its network to 384 correspondents in 71 countries. By 1970, it would grow to 2,400 scientists in 134 countries, plus many scientists in the U.S. government, from the Department of the Interior to NASA. The Smithsonian had a lot of experience with this sort of citizen science. In the 1940s, its volunteer network of weather observers became the precursor to the National Weather Service. But the CSLP was attempting to collate first drafts of scientific work at greater and more varied scale than the Smithsonian had ever done. Correspondents positively deluged the center. Some sent stray data, like bits of dirt or descriptions of strange mounds forming in Peru. Had the center seen anything like that? High school teachers and members of the Soviet Geophysical Committee alike wrote to express their gratitude for CSLP reports. Advertising account executives wrote to ask if the center could provide a reference for an active volcano that would serve as a set for a TV commercial. But the center's core work had to do with the sort of escalating environmental crises that would lead, only 2 years later after its opening, to the first Earth Day and the founding of the Environmental Protection Agency. During those same years, the center was established in the popular imagination as kind of an index of just how out of control everything had gotten. New Smithsonian Center investigates natural disasters as they happen, ran one Business Week headline. Smithsonian keeps tabs on nature's violent ways, proclaimed the Fort Lauderdale News and Sun Sentinel. CSLP even launched a dial a phenomenon phone line in 1969, which anyone could call to hear recorded descriptions of unfolding phenomena. If you think you have problems, a columnist wrote, call dial a phenomenon. Yesterday, for example, a cheerful-sounding young woman told callers that a huge comet was heading for Earth. The antics of the center were centering the public consciousness. Dick Cavett had Citron, the center's director, on his popular talk show the same night as John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And the novelist Renata Adler wrote about the center in her acclaimed, haunting 1976 novel Speedboat. In the end, though, the CSLP's relative fame could not sustain it. The problem the center was trying to solve would be much more simply addressed by a technology that debuted just 1 year after its founding, ARPANET, the precursor to the Internet. In short order, digital technology would make CSLP's strenuous networking, the frantic phone calls and airmail postcards, quaintly irrelevant and certainly too expensive. Facing perennial budget challenges, Citron began trying to reposition the center's work to contribute to the growing pool of networked global data that would power the new, intensively legislative phase of the environmental movement. Citron wrote, as a prototype of the monitoring systems that must surely follow, the center has shown that worldwide reporting networks, even when composed of loosely bound volunteers, can contribute to a significant overview of the planet. He became involved in the United Nations Environment Program, where he was a driving force behind a plan to integrate many environmental tracking systems around the globe, the Global Environment Monitoring System. That system still exists today. But it can be difficult to see all the hard, very human work behind a global data set. For instance, the work of investigating a mass migration of gray squirrels. As soon as CSLP got that report about squirrels on the move in 1968, the center called the scientists it knew might be interested in such a thing. including a University of Maryland zoologist named Vog Flieger. Flieger headed to North Carolina almost immediately and set up a laboratory in a motel room in a town called Boone, where he examined squirrel specimens. Meanwhile, the center kept in daily contact with various scientists and wildlife officials in the afflicted region and sent updates to 71 interested correspondents around the world. Squirrel migrations occur unannounced. By the time a biologist arrives on the scene to investigate the situation, the event has usually ended, Flieger wrote. This time was different. Flieger was studying it as it happened, and in the end, he could offer an explanation. The squirrels weren't fleeing because of fleas or psychological factors, as some previously suspected, nor because of any immediate threat of starvation. They were fleeing because in 1967, the trees had produced a strong crop of winter nuts, which led to more squirrels surviving the winter and hence to a larger squirrel population the next fall. Those squirrels were amply fed on berries and the like through the warmer months of 1968, but that year's crop of winter-ready foods was poor and would require stiffer competition with other squirrels. It was at this point, Flieger reasoned, that the squirrels recognized their dilemma and with an eye toward the long winter, lit out in search of better rations to bury confusing people all along the East Coast. Flieger's study made him the world's leading expert on squirrels. Decades later, it also goes to show how even the oddest of short-lived phenomena tend to be hooked up to a much bigger, slower, more complex dynamics. As Citron once said, it is the short-lived events in nature that tell you the most about natural systems. You just have to know where to look. Next, we'll move on to the prologue, the past is prologue section. An article titled Home Game by John Lingen. Wrigley Field, the coziest park in baseball, is also still the purest. The first Chicago Cubs game on the city's north side was held on April 20, 1916, and new fans flooded the neighborhood. The Chicago Tribune reported that 20,000 people attended the game, some of them spilling onto the field, such that an outfielder collided with a small boy in the seventh inning. A hit into the crowd was good for two bases, the reporter noted. Before the game even started, a circus mood prevailed. Cincinnati Reds player-manager Buck Herzog was presented with a bunch of roses, a walking stick and an umbrella, and a ceremony that also included fireworks, a half a dozen marching bands, a live donkey brought in by local Democrats, and an actual black bear cub who did tricks on home plate for a movie camera. A mile-long parade through the city carried box seat guests along the field to their seats. The Cubbies won 7-6 in 11 innings. The stadium on that day didn't yet have its famous ivy brick walls or scoreboard. It wasn't even called Wrigley Field. But fans' excitement for this spot on the corner of Clark and Addison Streets has scarcely waned in the past 109 years. Wrigleyville, as the whole neighborhood is now known, is the closest thing to United States to a baseball amusement park. And among MLB stadiums, only Boston's Fenway Park, opened in 1912, is older. It's also the only major league stadium designated as a National Historic Landmark. Wrigley is where Babe Ruth famously called his shot in 1932, pointing to the outfield before hitting a home run, and where Kerry Wood threw 20 strikeouts in one 1998 game. The story of this living monument begins with Charles Wiegman, a classic Chicago striver who could have stepped out on the pages of Sal Bellow or James T. Farrell. He is a man who has made himself, the Sporting News wrote of Wiegman in 1915, having started as a waiter in a restaurant, and now he owns a dozen or so of his own. Wiegman made a foray into professional sports in 1914 as owner of the Chicago Federals, the city's entrance in the new Federal League, an upstart challenger to the American and National Leagues. The team originally played on the DePaul University field, but Wiegman wanted to set his team apart from the city's South Side teams, and an open lot at Clark and Addison Streets had the added benefit of proximity to the streetcar and elevated lines. Wiegman was a crowd pleaser by nature. Let fans keep balls hit into the crowd and kept the bear cub outside the stadium for the entirety of 1916, greeting fans from a cage. He was also a promoter of women's attendance at games, becoming the first stadium owner to demand that the stands be hosed down between contests to keep refuse under control. The Federal League folded after the 1915 season, and the National League's Chicago Cubs, owned by Wiegman, moved from their home on the west side into Wiegman Park the following year. Chewing gum magnate William Wrigley Jr. bought the franchise in 1921 when the stadium was known as Cubs Park. He took advantage of the obvious advertising opportunity in 1926, renaming it for his family and thereafter his son, P.K. Wrigley, took an active interest. Wrigley Field underwent its most transformative change in 1937. Under P.K.'s management, one of renovation brought the famous ivy and brick wall, the hand-operated scoreboard that remains in use even today, plus upgraded bleachers that still stand, and which more than doubled the stadium's original capacity from 18,000 to 38,000. The stadium has grown to accommodate 41,000 fans, but thanks to its limited acreage, it still qualifies for its long-standing nickname, the Friendly Confines. Having reached a sort of perfection, Wrigley for years remained deliberately unchanged. Cubs ownership finally installed permanent lights for night games in August 1988, a decision likely made in order to secure the All-Star Game, which Wrigley hosted in 1990. Lights illuminated many legendary Wrigley moments, including Game 6 of the 2016 National League Championship Series. The Cubs won, securing the team's first World Series appearance in 71 years. The Cubs will go on to win that series, ending a 108-year championship drought, the longest in all U.S. sports. Yet the stadium has also made history in other sports. In 1933, Wrigley hosted a softball tourney, described in the Chicago American as the largest and most comprehensive tournament ever held in the sport, which has swept the country like wildfire. And it led to the creation of formal rules and governance for softball. During World War II, P.K. Wrigley opened the stadium to the All-American Girls Softball League so that fans could scratch their diamond sports itch while baseball players fought overseas. In football, the Bears played at Wrigley for 50 years before moving to Soldier Field. And in the 1940s and 50s, Wrigley hosted bustling rodeos with hundreds of participants. Still, Wrigley is foremost a baseball shrine. For many fans, and not only of the Cubs, Wrigley's close quarters, neighborhood location, and ivy and brick motif represent the embodiment of baseball's purest form, with beautiful eccentricities and old-school charm that can't be found in any other sport. It may not be exactly what your great-grandparents saw 110 years ago, but it's likely closer than any other stadium can offer. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.